As a small business, we really like to support the community around us, and we feel that NHPR is a very important part of New Hampshire's community.
Lydia West of Goose Bay Lumber of Chichester is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Goose Bay is a really small business with very limited advertising dollars, but with NHPR, not only do we reach our customer base, it feels good to be able to support NHPR.
Join NHPR's growing community of underwriters at nhpr.org/underwrite.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Civics teachers have had no shortage of real-world material for their students over the past 12 months, from the pandemic to a second impeachment trial to voter registration to protest and activism to the mob that attacked the Capitol, and an historic inauguration in January. Today in The Exchange, how civics teachers are making use of all this to explore and explain the fundamentals of U.S. government. Teachers, how are you incorporating this current moment in your classroom? And students, what lessons have been helpful for you? Email us at exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. Today, we're talking with two teachers who are taking unique approaches to their civics lessons. Our guests are Marianne Wessels, middle school social studies and humanities teacher at Gate City Charter School for the Arts. That's a public charter school in Merrimack that integrates art into the curriculum. Marianne Wessels, really nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Also with us, Benjamin Bacot, a high school English and social studies teacher at Waterville Valley Academy, a private school for student athletes. And Benjamin, great to have you too. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You're welcome.
So before we dive into how both of you are approaching civics lessons, just briefly tell us, Benjamin, you first, please, what's the situation with your classes right now in terms of in-person or online?
Right now, Waterville Academy is kind of in a unique situation. We're a really small full-time and part-time winter sports academy. So we're all full-term and in-person classes right now. It's a pretty special situation to be able to ski and enjoy being in Waterville Valley in the winter.
Wow. So you are full-time in-person. And like you said, you're a private school for winter athletes. How many kids do you have, Benjamin?
Right now, there's about 30 full-term students, and we have another around 30 part-time winter-term students who are ranging from middle school and high school winter athletes.
Wow. And how about your school, Mary Ellen?
We have about 142 students, and right now we're completely remote. We have a task force that meets pretty much every week to reassess and sort of talk about how to transition back into probably some kind of hybrid, and then eventually, hopefully, someday we'll get back to face-to-face.
Yeah, that's something we would all love, for sure. Mary Ellen, to you first. You know, as I said, you're a public charter school that integrates arts into the curriculum. In normal times, how would you describe your school and its approach towards teaching?
Well, our mission is arts integration. We are public and nonprofit, so we have kids coming from all over, mostly in the greater Nashua and Manchester kind of area, but we do get kids from other places too. And we try really hard to integrate arts into pretty much all of our teaching. So theater, drama, dance, art, visual arts, writing, creative writing. So we do try to bring that into our teaching as much as we can.
How does that change the way that information is understood or engaged with by students? I'm really interested in that, Mary Ellen.
Well, arts integration is really great for a lot of, and is really wonderful, is that it reaches a lot of different students with different abilities. So it's kind of easy to differentiate using the arts. Kids tend to find it really engaging. A lot of it is very hands-on, although I'm finding it more challenging during remote learning.
Right.
But it tends to really allow me to have creative lessons with my students and have them bring their own creativity in.
Yeah, I think we lost a little bit of you there, Mary Ellen. But I'll turn to you, Benjamin. You just said a moment ago you had 30 full-time high school students. You bring on about 30 more in winter. You've got some middle school students as well. How would you describe your school's approach toward education, just broadly?
Excellent. We are a school that takes pride in our education. We try to prepare students for the rigors of college and going on to the highest levels of academic success. So we have AP courses that we teach. We bring all of our classes very personalized settings, though, as well. That's one of the things that we pride ourselves with at the Academy. Since our student body is pretty small, we're able to provide very intimate settings and get to know all of our students in very small classroom settings, and therefore try to reach them individually where they need to be met, you know, whether it's pacing wise or whether it's the information that how we tailor it. These are all kind of driven by our student population.
So both of you, Benjamin, you first, please. How much time normally before this past 12 months would you devote to civics in your classes?
Well, I teach AP English Literature, AP English Language and Composition, and I teach World History. And before this, I would normally spend maybe a day or, you know, one class period a week or biweekly discussing current events or civics and trying to bring civic lessons into the classroom or into our study.
And how about this year, Benjamin? How much are you talking about it?
Oh, wow. This year is a new story. This year has been an excellent example of ways in which to explore the idea of what is your text for the classroom. This year, I've had a lot of fun throwing away the textbook and looking at current events as my textbook. The rhetoric and the things that we are seeing now have provided excellent lessons of how rhetoric and language can affect our daily lives and our experiences. So now I bring current events probably two or three times weekly to the classroom.
Wow. So you're just chucking the textbook basically, or that lesson plan for that day's civics lesson, Benjamin, and saying, I know we were going to talk about that, but we're going to talk about this now.
Yeah. I come to my classroom with the engagement pedagogy. You know, I think bringing my politics or my authentic self to the classroom actually enhances some of the discussions and some of the things that we can have and the topics that we can bring up in our discussion of whether it's English literature or whether it's historical events. Whether it's just rhetoric and how messages are passed and received. It's been an exciting year in that way.
Well, exciting is one way to put it. and I definitely want to ask you, Benjamin, a little bit later about your work with students on rhetoric and language and so forth. But Mary Ellen, how about you? How much time normally would you devote to civics, and how much time have you devoted to it over the past 12 months?
Well, I'm kind of in a different position in the sense that last year I actually had the luxury of teaching social studies. So I devoted, more time to civics and history. This year I'm teaching humanities, which means I've kind of been lumped into teaching ELA and social studies. And we're also sort of piloting in our school a new curriculum for the middle school. So we're trying out the Study Sync curriculum, which has been great for remote learning for ELA.
That's English language arts. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, sorry.
Marilyn, right?
Sorry,
yeah, that's okay.
Yes. but so it's been hard to fit it in. I think before I would have said that it was a pretty good balance. At least a few times a week, I would have touched on something to do with civics in one way or another. This year, I'm trying really hard to make sure I dedicate at least one day a week to in-person, like synchronous classes where I'm talking about it. And then usually I have some work on Wednesdays, which is a day we don't have classes, but we meet with them in advisory and then study hall. So usually on Wednesdays, I have some kind of work that relates to what we talked about in civics. But it's been tough because I only have about 45 minutes 4 days a week with them live. So it's been challenging to fit everything in. Certainly, I've been talking.
What about your colleagues, Mary Ellen? You know, what are you hearing from them in terms of the conversations that are going on in their classrooms? Classrooms, you know, with air quotes around it because you're virtual.
Well, for the, I think for the, so I have the whole middle school. So 6th, 7th, and 8th, the three classes.
Yeah.
And then the lower elementary and upper elementary, so K through 3 and then 4 and 5. I think they're certainly addressing current events, probably not as much as I am, just because of the age of their kids. But I know that, you know, they have been talking about like the election and things like that. So
I want to let our listeners know that we are talking about unique approaches towards civics education, given all that's going on in our country over the past 12 months. And we're going to dive into that right now with our guests. We'd also like to hear, of course, though, from you. What do you wish you learned in school about how our democracy works? What civics lessons do you remember from your own education? Let us know by email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can always use Facebook or you can give us a call, 800-892-6477. So, Benjamin, to you, how are your students interpreting all the political and social upheaval that they're seeing? How are they doing with all this? Do they find it interesting? Do they find it exhausting? Are they excited? Do they want it to just go away?
Well, a lot of the conversations I'm having in the classrooms are student driven, partially the nature of our school, but also partially the nature of our moment that we're going through. I think my students are a lot like the rest of the students in the country that are watching the youth particularly be involved in this moment. And they're trying to figure out where do they fit in with the current events and things along that nature. My students are very interested in the things that are coming on, and they're asking me questions about particularly the January 6th event. They're asking me questions about the electoral system, trying to make sense of, you know, the things that are happening and why these events are happening according to, you know, the things that are traditionally supposed to happen. So it's been a little bit of a civics lesson just to give them context about the electoral system, about certifying votes, about why the electoral system exists in the first place. Those have been kind of just unpacking the terminology, but then when we see kind of the aftermath of what have happened, it's kind of shocking to all of my students, particularly to see what the traditionally should expect and what has been kind of happening in the last month and particularly this school year.
Sure. So since you're going there, Benjamin, let's go there. Let's go back to January 6th. And both of you, as you watched what unfolded at the Capitol, Mary Ellen, you first, what were your first thoughts about how to talk to kids about this? Your students are younger, middle schoolers.
Right. Yeah. Well, my first thoughts were, oh my God, how am I going to talk about this?
Right. I bet.
Fortunately, there was sort of an emergency online Twitter chat for the Social Studies Network on Twitter, and that was really helpful. So I ended up, actually what I ended up doing was ditching what I had originally planned. And the next day, I used a protocol that's visual thinking strategies that I really love to use. And I won't try to get into it because it's one of my personal soapboxes. But anyway, but it's a great way of processing information and making observations in a way that really honors all of the observations. And so I took several images from the day, and we just kind of VTS has three basic steps, which is, you know, what's going on in this picture? What do you see that makes you say that? What more can we find? And it was great. I processed some various pictures from the day, and they had some really, really good observations. They were pretty unsettled, I think. And we have a diverse political spectrum. We had, you know, some ardent Trump supporters, and we had several adamant that they were not. And so we try really hard to just have a respect for the diversity of opinion that we have. So
that's interesting. With your school's focus on the arts, you had students, Mary Ellen, work with images of what happened and then sort of use that as a way to interpret and process that whole event. That's really interesting. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much how I approached it anyway, the day right after, yeah.
So how about you, Benjamin? What went through your mind? And then what sort of tools or methods did you use to process this with your older students, your high schoolers?
Awesome. Yeah, similar to Mary Ellen. First, I try to establish a safe space, you know, for the students. I do wear my politics on my sleeve, but ultimately in my classroom, I want to allow room for discourse and dialogue. And never at any point in my classroom do I want to make my students feel like they can't share an opinion, even if it goes against what is the popular opinion. But as we approached that moment, I thought about how do I set up and create these intimate spaces for the students to be able to talk. And so one of my favorite strategies is to use a Socratic seminar where there's, you know, a larger group that listens, and then you can have smaller intimate conversations within the small group, and then bring in members from the outside to interchange with the smaller group. And therefore everyone can listen in on the conversations that are going, but the speakers get to feel like they're having an intimate conversation with just the instructor. Or whether I do it with journals or whether I create group work, but how do I foster that space where the students are safe and feel like they can share their opinions? That was my first and foremost idea of going into that moment and how to address it in the classroom. But also, I'm a Black man and I can't hide my discomfort sometimes as I watched January 6th unfold. And I think it's important for our students to see different reactions, people modeling dialogue, people modeling discomfort, but also how do we work past our discomfort to find some sort of shared understanding of the events, some sort of way to move forward beyond our discomfort.
Well, and I know that you focus on language and how it's used and rhetoric and so forth, Benjamin. So what words are you using with your students to describe what we saw on January 6th? And why is word choice so important?
Well, I struggled with this at first, and I believe word choice is extremely important. So I talked about some of the keywords that we saw in the news. I talked about insurrection and helped them find definitions for it. I talked about white supremacy and the history of it and how it intersects with politics and some of the ugliness that we've seen over the years. But I also talked about allyship. I talked about the intersectionality of entertainment and race and some of the beautiful things that we've seen come out of the summer. With support for Black Lives Matters across the spectrum of sports and entertainment and music. So I tried to explain things like Antifa as well. It's some of these terms are tossed about as if our students have the context and understanding of them, but yet it's easier for us to just let it kind of go by instead of approaching those things in the classroom. And I wanted to call it out the way I saw it.
How did your students respond to you, Benjamin, when you talked about all this really tough stuff?
Well, like I said, I'm a teacher that kind of jumps right into these issues because I feel that we're preparing our students for a very diverse future that we as teachers don't even understand and can't predict what their future will be like. However, what we do know about New Hampshire students particularly is most of them will not settle down here. They will go on to college elsewhere or career in their lives elsewhere that are more diverse than our New Hampshire population. And so I want to prepare my students to respect diversity, but also to appreciate different viewpoints and not necessarily feel like they have to agree or feel intimidated by differences. So when I was, you know, honest and passionate about the way I saw things, I could see that it was affecting to my students, but yet I could also allow room for them to disagree as far as who they blamed or held responsible for the what I called insurrection at the Capitol.
Ellen, how about you? Again, this is weighty stuff for middle schoolers. What words did you use to describe what was going on? What have you heard from other teachers about how they're sort of working their way through this in terms of a civics lesson?
Well, actually, I have to be honest, I've been a little bit tiptoeing on it, trying to sort of figure out still how to move forward. Interestingly, one of my resources that I really love to use lately has been the shout out to New Hampshire Public Radio Civics 101 podcast, which has been really great. And I just recently was listening to one of their short little episodes where a teacher talked about how she used definitions, and you looked at the definitions of the different words and what do words mean. And I can't honestly say I've done that yet, although that is definitely part of my plan for moving forward. It's been tough. I mean, they had a lot of really great questions, and it really sparked a lot of good discussion. And one thing that became even more clear to me, I'd already been committed to this, and I've been trying to sort of fit in the really excellent civic online reasoning curriculum that Stanford History Education Group has, which is kind of more for high school, I think, but I find it works really well if I adapt it a little bit. And it's just become so clear to me that even more than I felt before, that I have to look at how do we get our news? How can we encourage our students to be critical consumers of media? I mean, I think that's hugely important right now. So that's definitely something I'll be focusing in on as we progress this year.
Well, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, Mary Ellen, you teed me up perfectly for a couple emails that I want to share. You can email us as well. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Also, teachers and students, tell us what creative projects you've been doing in your civics classes over this past year and what you learned from them. Again, our number is 800-892-6477, and our email is exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Civics teachers have had a wealth of real-world examples for students over the past year. And this hour, we're looking at unique ways to explore and explain what's happening in our country, from public health rules due to the pandemic to the riot at the Capitol. So teachers and parents, what are some creative ways you're talking about civics and the current moment with children? Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or you can call 800-892-6477. We're talking with Mary Ann Wessels. She teaches middle school at Gate City Charter School for the Arts in Merrimack. Also, Ben Bako, a high school teacher at Watervale Valley Academy. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And both of you, here's some emails that have come in. Bob in Lee writes, I think that the recent attack on the U.S. Capitol by the Stop the Steal mob and all that led up to it can be blamed in part on the failure of our education system. The remedy would be to teach critical thinking and civics, etc. However, Bob says, I fear that any such reforms would be met by fierce resistance and be labeled as brainwashing our children. And Michael has a related email. How does civics relate to the idea that schools should teach students how to think, not what to think? Both great points from Michael and Bob. Thanks for writing. And Benjamin, I'll turn to you first. To Bob's point, you know, critical thinking, civics, teaching kids how to think, not what to think, as Michael put it. Go ahead, Benjamin.
Excellent point. Yeah, I agree exactly with the email because how to think, it goes across subject matters. It doesn't matter whether we're talking civics or whether we're talking English language or history or even math and sciences. Critical thinking is what I fear is missing right now amongst our larger society. And I do take a little bit of responsibility. I feel extra I feel extra motivated to help teach those critical thinking lessons and the evaluation of sources, particularly in light of some of the recent events.
Give us a little bit more on that. That's interesting. So you're saying you're taking a little responsibility for showing students how to examine information more critically? Is that what you're saying, Benjamin?
Often I think students feel the pressure to get the right answer, and they feel less it's important to understand how they got to that answer. And in my own practice, I've tried to examine the ways in which I reward students' effort before they get to that final solution. So how do I help them see more value in the journey than in the result? Critical thinking is one of those skills, whether it's in research or writing or in judgment of historical events, you have to be able to have those skills. And I feel extra empowered to try to instill those skills in the activities that I do.
Oh, that's really interesting what you just said, Benjamin, because often, my kids' math teachers would say, show your work, show the process by which you came to this conclusion. But you're applying the same sort of methodology to working through, language and rhetoric and so forth. Break it down for me, one, two, three, how you got there.
Exactly. Yeah. So the author makes this point rhetorically, and this rhetorical that understanding then help you see the larger message of Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail, for instance.
Wow. How about you, Mary Ellen? The idea that both Bob and Michael are putting forward that, civics education needs to teach students how to think, not what to think.
Yeah, I'm laughing because I was sitting there listening to Benjamin nodding vigorously. Yeah, I definitely that's a huge part of what I think is important. And it's interesting, it's a little abstract, I guess, sounding, but it really does connect really well to our mission of arts integration, because one of the things that I focus in a lot with them on, stepping back from civics, is just in general the idea of critique and what is critique. And I do another thing I use a lot is a protocol called Liz Lehrman's Critical Response Process. And she's a dancer, but it works really beautifully as a way of getting feedback. And a lot of our students really think anytime they hear the word critical, they think it's negative. And we've talked a lot about how when you're critiquing something, it doesn't have to be negative. It has to be, let's really look at this. Let's look carefully. Let's think about it. Let's process it. So I think that it is sort of our students, especially my middle school students, have kind of a very fast-paced kind of making judgments about things. You see a friend's post on social media, and that's your information right there, So we're working a lot on diving in and really looking at different sources and comparing and contrasting and trying to, how do we make our own decisions critically?
That's interesting, and I'm so glad you mentioned that, Mary Ellen, because the fast pace of information that especially young people just kind of, just it's always coming at them. They're always scrolling on their phones and so forth. And yet critical thinking, Mary Ellen, seems to me requires a slowdown, a piece by piece, a looking at it one, two, three. So how do you kind of put those two sort of one very fast and one more methodical? How do you put that together? That's a
Well,
challenge.
it is a challenge. I mean, I definitely have done a lot of stepping back, looking at primary sources, and and creating primary sources. You know, I've done a lot of work with them in last year and this year, the end of last year and this year, about how I say to them, you're always living through history, but right now you really are living through history. I said, you know, you are really living through a time that we know people will be studying and looking at, and your own opinions and thoughts and processes of it, you know, your art, your writing, your journals, that is potentially a primary source for someone looking at the times. So I've done a lot of with them creating their own primary sources, but we've also tried to look at other primary sources and, you know, comparing them and sort of getting the idea of, just because someone was there, is it necessarily mean it's a good source? And how do you, you know, how do you find good sources and then transferring that forward to current times? And how can you, you know, how can you compare and contrast different sources of media instead of just getting all of your information from one source? You know, whether it's NPR or Fox News or whatever, how do you get lots of information and compare it in a way that doesn't overwhelm you, but does give you a more balanced picture?
Oh, that's really interesting. So, and you know, we've all watched those Ken Burns documentaries where sort of a sober person will read, you know, my diary, you know, January 5th, you know, and you're saying these kids' diaries or journals or writings, Marianne, that you're having them do in class, you're telling them, look, this is history right now. What you are writing about, what you are living through with the pandemic and everything else, you know, that's history, just as much as the, you know, the letter from Gettysburg in a Ken Burns documentary.
Yeah. I think, and one thing, especially with middle school, and I don't know if Benjamin would agree with high school students, but certainly with middle schoolers, I feel like a lot of them are really surprised when I try to stress to them that you can shape, you know, you may not be able to vote yet, but you can still participate civically. You know, you can, that what you do matters, that your own thoughts and art and writing is important, and you have a voice that should be heard. So I feel like they're very surprised by that. They were really interested when I happened to mention the Tinker versus Des Moines court case, where, you know, it was free speech in the 60s, I think. Anyway, Vietnam War. And they were really excited. They said, wait, you mean a student brought it all the way to the Supreme Court? And I said, yep. So it's nice to get them excited. They feel overwhelmed too, to be fair, and just kind of apathetic in the sense of, like, they're very lethargic. They feel disconnected right now. So it's hard to keep them engaged and to make them feel like there really is a world that they're part of right now, I think.
Yeah, sure. And the remote learning, you know,
it's tough.
It challenging, definitely.
Yeah,
hard to get engaged after hour five or six on yet another Zoom meeting. Let's go back to our listeners. Bob and Michael, thank you for writing. Jennifer is calling in. Good morning, Jennifer. You're on the air from Hebron. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Yeah, good morning. I was just thrilled with this conversation, so thank you. And I love all that's being said about critical thinking. But to go back to what we were talking about at the beginning in terms of kids' emotional well-being, I think when a crisis happens, as has happened, or when current events are happening, it's important to give students that outlet to just ask questions, to air their feelings. The school may be the only place that that's happening, and it's really important for that to continue to happen despite politics. I think back, 20 years ago at 9/11, I was teaching in the seventh grade, and I spent two class periods talking about it with kids. And I still have those kids that see me today that say, thank you.
Wow.
That was one of the most beneficial things in my educational career.
Jennifer, I'm so glad you called. Yeah, thank you. And Benjamin, to you first, what about that? Just like you said earlier, kind of chucking the lesson for the day and just saying, okay, class, how are we doing?
Oh, well, to the caller's point, I'm a father, and my 14-year-old son, he talks about this subject with me, and we talk about it at home, but he doesn't get a chance to have these discussions at school, and I feel sad for him that he doesn't. But that doesn't mean these conversations aren't happening. They're happening in the hallways, they're happening in the cafeterias, and I agree with the caller that the students need a place to have these conversations, to air out their concerns, and to do it in a safe place where their opinions are valued. Mary Ellen raised the earlier point about students' experiences and their opinions, and how does that value show up in our curriculum? And in the AP coursework, one of the questions for AP is based on your experience. And so it's just relatively recently that we're starting to reward students for their opinion on high-level exams, on these things. And so bringing that voice into the classroom, especially at a young age, and having them see value in expressing themselves and practicing their critical thinking, I think is an excellent tool and should be implemented more in our classrooms.
Mary Ellen, how about you? How would you respond to Jennifer's question?
Oh, yeah, I feel that very much. That's part of the reason why my own approach the day after January 6th was just to basically process it. I mean, I use VTS and photographs as a way of accessing that, but mostly I just left room for discussion about how they were feeling and what questions they had and what worries they had. And I really worry a lot about our students. I'm a parent too. I have three grown stepdaughters, and actually my own boys are one's in college and one's they're both 19 and 20. So they're definitely, you know, I'm not in school right now, but it's really hard. And I try so hard to make a space for discussion for them. And that's challenging because some of my students really participate much less online than they would in the classroom. Some of them do still, one thing I've been doing a lot is using a tool called Pear Deck, just because it lets me let them participate with it being anonymous. And I find that for whatever reason, they're even more afraid than they would be normally about saying something wrong. So I find that if it's anonymous, I still know what they said, but it's, they don't have to necessarily share what they said. They can just say it without worrying about feeling stupid. So I think that's been really helpful, but it's a challenge to try to have these kinds of conversations when it's, 20 blank little black boxes and maybe one or two have their camera on, and it's tough.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So normally in a classroom, there's always, a couple kids who speak up a lot and a couple kids who almost never speak up. But you are seeing, Mary Ellen, more kids just not speaking up, given that it's online.
Yeah, I think so. I think that it was easier to sort of gently prod the ones who are less communicative. It was easier to do that when we were in person and I could kind of walk around and just be encouraging. So I'm just trying to find new tools,
Sure.
Like I said, I've been trying to find things like Pear Deck and Jamboard and different tech tools that let us sort of collaboratively create knowledge in a way that makes them feel safe.
All right. Well, coming up, I'm going to ask how you guys dealt with impeachment. Also, one of you mentioned free speech. So we'll talk about how you are sort of presenting lessons around that. Also, listeners, we want to keep hearing from you. Jennifer, thank you for that call. If you're a parent, what cool teaching strategies have you seen your kids' teachers try during remote learning around civics? How do you think these civics conversations should go with our students? Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, creative ways educators are making use of the past wild year in American government and politics to teach U.S. civics. Exchange listeners, as always, we love hearing from you. What do you wish you had learned in school that would help you understand this current political moment? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call 800-892-6477. Our guests are Marion Wessels, a middle school teacher at Gate City Charter School for the Arts, and Benjamin Baycote, a high school teacher at Waterville Valley Academy. And a couple more concepts I want to put in front of you and hear how you are trying to manage your way through them. And again, things are happening so quickly, sometimes it's hard to keep up. Benjamin, to you first, we hear a lot now about free speech and where the line came with that January 6th protest that turned into a riot, that turned into what a lot of people are calling an insurrection. How did you work with the free speech angle of this, Benjamin? We could spend a whole hour on this topic.
Yeah. Wow. That was interesting and difficult to manage as well. As you look at the January 6th, free speech came up in my classroom, particularly when we talked about the Twitter ban that the president and other figures are now under, and how the free speech and free speech works along with the social contract that we all must live under. You know, we talked about the yelling fire in the crowded theater and things along that nature, and how the limits of free speech. I also tried to give them a little more context about how did we get to this place in trying to police language, especially the language of politicians, you know, and that kind of led us into a further discussion on rhetoric. And it is a tricky thing because we as Americans value free speech. It's one of our highest ideals, but yet we also value diversity and we value different opinions. So there is that line that I was trying to help the students see. And we looked at, even at world events, you know, some of the events that are happening in France, unfortunately, the sad tragedies of as they're debating free speech as well.
Wow. How about you, Mary Ellen? This is, again, one that we could devote many hours to, but I do wonder how you're sorting through, you know, teaching them about the First Amendment, but also talking about the First Amendment in the current context.
To be honest, I've mostly been stepping back and looking at it historically with a sort of end goal of trying to gently bring it into the current events soon, I hope. But we've been looking at, well, you mentioned impeachment. We've been looking at impeachment historically. We've been looking at protest and the historical protests. And we've talked a little bit about some of the examples of protest and how it has potentially changed our government, like Shay's Rebellion and suffragettes. And we haven't gotten into the First Amendment a lot, I'm sad to admit, but
well, it's only mid-year. It's only January.
That's right. As we dived in, you know, started to do a bit of a dive into the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, we certainly have touched on it, but we haven't done a deep dive into it yet. So,
all right. Well, again, our number is 800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Margaret says she's listening in and she thinks Ben should run a class for adults. We all sure could use it. There you go, Ben. Michael writes, I love this question. What historical figure or philosophy most greatly influences your guest's framework for discussing civics? Michael, thank you for that. Go ahead, Benjamin.
Well, what a great question, Michael. Thank you so much. On my little list of notes, I have this quote about the boomerang of history by Ralph Ellison. And he's one of my favorite writers, thinkers, period. But I look at not only the current events as a way to see the boomerang of history come back around, but also as a way to kind of upset the traditional norms and our expectations of just going to school, having the same lesson plan and your traditional expectations from class to class. And when we get to teach civics, when we get to teach the current events, we can kind of interrupt that pattern and then help students see the inverted lens of history, shall we say. You know, how lens is not, history is not necessarily just teleological, and but we're actually creating history at this current moment. So excellent question.
What was that word you used, Benjamin? Teleological?
Teleological, yeah.
What is that?
It's kind of like if you look through a telescope and you're looking at one end and it's really tiny and then it kind of gets big and you project out into the future. And where you start at the Big Bang and now here we are at the present moment and everything is kind of sequence of cause and event instead of history is more present. History is alive and it's with us dynamic today. And as we act, we are shaping history. So, yeah.
Well, Mary Ellen, I love this question from Michael. So which historical figure or philosophy influences your framework, Mary Ellen, for discussing civics or other similar topics with your students?
Oh, boy.
How much time do we have? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I will say that I actually love Ralph Ellison's writing, but actually James Baldwin, I keep coming across these quotes that just jump right out at me of James Baldwin talking about history. I used to have right underneath my flag in my classroom his quote about, I love America more than any other country, which is why I reserve the right to perpetually criticize her, or something along those lines. But I keep coming back to that and thinking I must read even more James Baldwin. But also I really appreciate Sam Weinberg's processes and the Stanford History Education Group and the way it really looks at history and civic online reasoning. So that's been a big go-to. I don't know if I could honestly say I have a particular historical figure.
Well, if someone asked me on the spot, you know, that question, I would have a hard time too, because there's so many. But I really appreciate the question, Michael. And here's one from Phil in Loudoun who wrote in. He says, according to PBS.org, as of the first day of 2020, non-Hispanic whites under age 18 are in the minority now. And by 2045 or so, non-Hispanic whites will be in the national minority. What is the impact of this on student discussion? And Benjamin, I'll turn to you. As our country grows more diverse, how does that change the presentation of civics and history?
Oh, great question. Well, history has always had a central viewpoint and how we teach history and how we approach it traditionally has helped to reinforce the status quo, that kind of dominant narrative that has reinforced, unfortunately, the place where we are and kind of some of the controversies where we find ourselves. There's a lot of ways in that we can reject some of those traditional thinking and help undermine some of the negativity that we see in the world through just keep pushing critical events and critical thinking, critical discussion of current events. That sort of engagement helps undermine that kind of tendency for narrow or simplistic or ethnocentric thinking. As we help bring diverse voices into classrooms, then we'll help necessarily show that appreciation for diversity, for empathy. That's how we can engender those kind of intangible qualities that we want with our students, as well as the tangible qualities of reading and writing and analysis, you know. But
that's interesting. Yeah. So in terms of, let's say, source materials, what and given that the country's growing more diverse, given that we did see, you know, this, I hate to use the word racial reckoning because it's been used so much, but we've seen a racial justice movement that, you know, has not been seen at this scale for a long, long time. So given all that, Benjamin, what source materials might civics leaders use today that they might not have thought to use 15 years ago?
Absolutely. I think whenever we're looking at source material, one of the guidelines that I try to hold are not only bringing in diverse voices and diverse approaches to the curriculum, but also when I'm working with the curriculum itself, am I creating activities or discussions that are going to enact harm or perpetuate the harm, or am I celebrating those diverse voices, or am I celebrating the resistance that are in the text that we encounter? Am I using text that is culturally diverse in a way that doesn't appropriate or flatten the cultural experiences of others, i.e., am I trying to use somebody else's experience to explain my own, or do I try to show honor to those texts through being aware of the potential traumatic impact of their own voices, of their own histories? I think it's really important for us not to center our own voices or our own experiences in our classroom and yet try to elevate the diverse voices that we see in our classrooms as well.
Phil, thanks for writing. And here's one from Margaret that I'll throw to you, Mary Ellen. Margaret says, as part of Girl Zines A Go-Go, I have helped teachers use zines as a format for students to present their learning and ideas. Zines are an excellent way for students to produce primary sources because, unlike journals or diaries, their purpose is to be shared, not just hand-to-hand, but in libraries and at public events. They also develop skills in the interaction of image and word, collaboration, and the public power of speech. So, Mary Ellen, this sounds creative, and your school is focused on using arts in the curriculum. Zines is sort of short for magazines, right, Mary Ellen? So what do you think about what Margaret writes?
I love the idea. I hope I can somehow get in touch with her. So I'm old enough that I remember years ago when I sort of first kind of discovered the world of science fiction fans and stuff, that there was something they called fanzines, which I assume is kind of what this is. I do think that, zines and fanfic, I think potentially it's a really great opportunity for students to have a real world audience for their voices and to develop. I love to tell my students when we're writing, we did NaNoWriMo and we did other kinds of writing things, and I've talked to them and I've said, I have a friend who's won, I forget how many, Hugo Awards for her science fiction and fantasy, and she started out writing fanfics. So it's a great supportive community overall, I think. I think it's a great potential, although I sheepishly admit, and this is why I hope I can get in touch with her, I don't feel like I've taken enough advantage of that, but I do think it's a really great idea, and I'd love to hear other people that are using that.
Margaret, thanks for writing in. And what do you think about Phil's point, Mary Ellen, how more diverse classrooms are going to affect the way that civics are presented? Benjamin mentioned, some of the new source materials that teachers need to bring in. How are you sort of looking at primary sources these days, given changes in our country?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that is fortunate, I think, for us, that certainly is very different from when I was, I guess, theoretically learning civics, although I don't remember learning much about civics when I was in middle school. But anyway, one thing that's definitely different, I think, is that we have, the entire Library of Congress and the National Archives right online. I mean, it's just amazing the stuff you can access. So it's wonderful for finding diverse primary sources. I mean, I almost feel like that plays more into my teaching literature in some ways, because our school is only about 19% minority right now. I know New Hampshire is, I think, like 93% white, according to the 2019 census, as I recall, although I'm not sure if that's exactly right. But so I really, really love the opportunity to bring in books that I feel like give a diverse perspective in a not preachy, just, matter of fact way that's authentic. And I love, and you can't always use this because parents aren't always really happy with you using it, but I love Sherman Alexie's book, The Absolutely True Story of a Part-Time Indian, because it's just kind of a funny, matter of fact, true, sometimes difficult, but also sometimes really funny story about a kid who grew up on the res. And I really like to find books like that, The Hate U Give and things like that, that I think give kids a perspective of a life that's not part of their story. And they realize that there are so many different stories to listen to and read.
Well, as somebody who's been covering American government and civics for a long time, I myself was going back to my constitution a couple times this year going, wait, what does that term mean again? And can they really do that? Benjamin, how about you? What have you learned this year about civics yourself?
Oh, man, I've had to brush up on a few terms.
Yeah, me too.
Always or some of the procedural movements that are going on in the Senate right now. I think it's really important for us to stay aware of all the events, and I haven't watched as much news and C-SPAN this last few years ever in my life. And it is kind of a learning experience trying to catch up and stay ahead of my students. But I feel like it's my responsibility as well.
Benjamin, it's great to talk to you. We'll talk to you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's Benjamin Baycote, a high school English and social studies teacher at Waterville Valley Academy, a private school for student athletes. And Marianne Wessels, it was nice to meet you too. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm really happy to have been here.
That's Mary Ellen Wessels, a middle school social studies and humanities teacher at Gate City Charter School for the Arts. That's a public charter school in Merrimack. Today's show was produced by Exchange producer Christina Phillips. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.